Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM IMS Version 10 Migration Education Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. All lines on today's conference will be open and interactive, so we do ask that you use a mute button to help cut down on background noise when not speaking. To access today's web-based presentation, please go to http://www.ibm.com/collaboration/center/attend-frame-set.jsp?Question mark session ID equals B for boy, number 8, F for Frank, 3, 2, 1, 7, E for Edward, the number 8, A for Apple, A for Apple, E for Edward, 1, 4, C for cat, 5, 5, B for boy, 9, 6, A for Apple, 4, 9, 6, F for Frank, E for Edward, A for Apple, 6, 0, 4, F for Frank, and the number 7. Once again, that is https://www.ibm.com/collaboration/web/conferences/center/attend-frame-set.jsp?Question mark session ID equals B for boy, the number 8, F for Frank, 3, 2, 1, 7, E for Edward, the number 8, A for Apple, A for Apple, E for Edward, 1, 4, C for cat, 5, 5, B for boy, 9, 6, A for Apple, 4, 9, 6, F for Frank, E for Edward, A for Apple, 6, 0, 4, F for Frank, 7.
At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to your presenter, Mr. Jeff Nichols. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Nikki, thank you very much for that introduction. Welcome back to our IMS version 10 class. I must apologize that the web address has changed. I thought that I had set the web conference up yesterday for 2 days of sessions rather than just one, but it turns out I was wrong. So we have a different address today. Is there anyone on the call that does not have access to the web conference at the moment?
Once again, all lines are open.
Okay. So given that there's no response, I know that Sudhakar Surya, Tomarudo-san, and William Wang are all on the web conference. I assume then that there are no other people who are listening that have not been able to get to the web conference.
I can see.
You can see?
Yes,
William,
I can see.
Okay, William, that's good. Good. Okay, well, thank you very much all for coming back. Today we have the second part of our IMS 10 class. We got through nearly as much as we were hoping to get through yesterday, so today we've got quite a deal more material to go through. And without taking any more time, let me pass over to Robert, who will go through the IMS Transaction Manager enhancements that we've made. Thanks, Robert.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. If you're looking at the extra handouts, we're in Section 9, which is the Transaction Manager section. Otherwise, follow it on the screen. So, we're now going to go into the Transaction Manager. Close that. Okay, there are some changes made within the Transaction Manager to the MSC, or Multiple System Coupling Facilities. That's the facility where it's an internal IMS to IMS communication protocol, and you can ship transactions between IMSs. So there are changes to that environment. There are changes to the APPC environment, and the removal of BTAM support for anyone still having some old BTAM devices. I'll talk about each of those. So I will move forward, first of all, and look at all the MSC changes that have been included in IMS version 10. IMS version 10 removes the routing exit routines that were replaced by the Transaction Manager and MSC Message Routing and Control User Exit, DFS MSC E0, which began and was available with IMS version 7. So the exit DFS MSC E0 has been around now for some time, and it is there and runs currently in parallel with the other four exits listed on the screen. As of IMS version 10, those four exits, the DFS CMTR0, DFS NPRT0, DFS CMLR0, and DFS CMPR0, are no longer available and will not work. DFS MSC E0, the new consolidated exit, consolidates and replaces all of those exits. And if you want the full name for it, the MSC Terminal Routing Exit, the MSC Input Message Routing Exit, the MSC Link Receive Routing Exit, and the MSC Program Routing Exit. They are now being removed in IMS version 10 and will no longer be supported or called. DFS MSC E0 must be used. An extra note with that is that DFS MSC E0 can be used in both MSC and non-MSC environments, so you do not need MSC to be able to use the functionality in this exit, although obviously not all the routing options will apply to the non-MSC IMS systems. So if you are using any one of those four exits that were previously mentioned in IMS version 7, 8 or 9, you must, prior to going to version 10, recode the functionality that you've got in there into the new DFS MSC E0. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. The other main functionality to do with MSC is increased bandwidth, and that will improve the MSC link performance. To improve the performance, the bandwidth requirements of high-volume MSC systems, many customers use a large number of parallel MSC links between pairs of IMS systems. This scheme can complicate the operations of a system and the complexity, as well as load balancing. IMS version 10 introduces several enhancements to increase MSC bandwidth, being, first of all, the blocking. It can block multiple messages and responses into a single buffer when sending messages across the MSC link. In previous releases, IMS only sent one message or response at a time. It will reduce the logging I/O operations because of the number of check write calls. Simply by reducing the number of buffers used, because it can consolidate more messages into fewer buffers, that will automatically reduce the amount of logging done by each of these buffers and a check write required to log each of these buffers. The maximum link buffer size has also increased from 32K to 64K. And you have the capability to dynamically increase or decrease the size via an IMS command. And there are also some enhanced link query statistic commands available. There's also VTAM generic resource support for MSC links, and I'll go into that a little bit later. Any questions at this point? Okay, more about the removal of the old MSC links. So, as we mentioned before, DFS MSC E0 replaces the user exit, or user exits listed there. I'm not going to read them all out again. The old exits were still supported in IMS version 7, 8, and 9. All the functionality available in the old exits is now available in DFS MSC E0. So all the functionality you might need is in there. So it's just a matter of taking the code and translating it as appropriate not just copying it through, but translating it into the functionality inside the exit. As a result, there are a few changes to the IMS system definition macros. The no MSPEX or MSP exit and the no MSLEX or MSL exit parameters are now ignored during the IMS stage 1 if you still code them, and you'll get a warning message with the G092. It won't stop the gen from running, but you'll get some warning messages. The old exits are no longer called by IMS, even if they exist. So it's no point trying to ignore this fact and move forward. Those exits will not be called, and they will not work. Increased bandwidth and some background. The input and output buffer in previous releases would send messages on a physical link. The link was defined with a bus size on the MSP link macro at system definition, and it was applicable for the duration that the link is active. So you couldn't change the size of the buffer. It was fixed and would not account for any increased traffic. Only one message or response could be sent per buffer. Even if the buffer was large enough to hold multiple messages or responses, it was still only one message per buffer. And the next message would not be sent until the partner IMS responds. That is, it's been received at the other side of the MSC link, queued into the IMS message queue on the other side, and the message had been logged. And all that had to occur before the buffer was released and available for another message to be sent. Yes. The benefits now allow much more flexibility. I think something just happened to my screen there. Okay. So in a bit of summary of both of those items together, use of the Transaction Manager and MSC Message Routing Control User Exit, the FSMSC0, consolidates the older messages and provides a variety of enhanced options. It reduces the number of exit routines, provides a more consistent set of routing capabilities for all types of messages, and provides a much simpler environment for maintenance. The bandwidth will now provide you with greater control over the capacity of the MSC links. It allows for the reduction in parallel links to support the different throughput, supports a dynamic display and a change of the link buffer size, improves the efficiency and performance of the links themselves, and reduces the logger check-write requirements. So it makes it much simpler to not only provide a much better throughput because it's making better use of the storage and the buffers, but also allows you to increase or decrease the number of buffers you've got or the size of the buffers as appropriate. And that can be done via command. There's also a new query statistics command and it provides the ability to fine-tune and analyze the link performance. It's an easy way to access the link statistics, and it can assist in defining the optimum buffer sizes. MSC VGR support. VGR stands for VTAM Generic Resources. For anyone who isn't familiar, in an IMS Sysplex, VTAM Generic Resources can be used as a single point of entry into an IMS system from the network. So instead of having to know that you've got, say, five IMSs in an IMS Plex, IMSs 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you need to know which IMS you need to log on to, you can just say you want to log on to IMS, and VTAM Generic Resources will route your request through to whichever IMS is the most appropriate one to take your request at that point in time, usually based on workload or the number of sessions connected. So VTAM Generic Resources is now supported for MSC. Prior to this, an MSC link was between two IMSs, as an example, IMS A or IMS B. And you had no more flexibility. So if you wanted one IMS to connect to all IMSs within a Plex, externally, then you would have to have a link between your external single IMS and all the ones in the Plex. So the enhancements to the existing IMS VTAM generic resource functionality allows access through the MSC links. It's an initial implementation for MSC via VTAM generic resources. And it's in local mode with VTAM managed affinities. So it means there's no MSC data in the coupling facility, no support for the resource manager. So it's purely done via the network. In the future, there hopes to be a global mode using the resource manager and probably the coupling facility to manage it in even a better method, a better manner. Here's a picture. Without VTAM generic resources, which is what is happening prior to IMS version 10, you could have two IMSs, IMS A and IMS B, as indicated in the picture, and they would have a dedicated MSC link defined. So IMS A would have to have definitions pointing directly at IMS B, and IMS B would have to have definitions pointing directly back at IMS A. The parallel lines in between just show that you can have multiple logical links within the one physical link. And that link was between IMS A and IMS B, and that is it. And you can't connect to other IMSs with that one physical link. The bottom half of the picture shows the MSC environment with VTAM generic resources in play. So you can see that the IMS A environment has a physical link and it points to something. It's still referring to IMS B, which is the red link in between, in exactly the same way it was before. However, IMS B is now defined not as an IMS system, but as a VTAM generic resource. And so it is VTAM itself that will determine whether the IMS A is going to connect with IMS 1 or IMS 2 or IMS 3. IMS 1, 2 and 3 being three IMSs as part of the IMS B Plex. So IMS B in this case is referring to a plexed environment with three IMSs within it. So you don't have to worry about which of the IMSs within the Plex you're connecting to. You just need to connect to the Plex. Does that help explain how the VTAM generic resources works? Any questions on that to date? I'll assume everybody got that. I'll move on. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the APPC changes. There are three specific improvements within APPC IMS with IMS version 10. There's enhanced timeout granularity. There's a support for the lock and the unlock commands from both APPC and OTMA clients. And there's local LU support. Let's talk about each one. First of all, enhanced timeout granularity. The APPC MVS capability for timeout has been supported in IMS since version 6, and in ZOS version 1.7, APPC enhanced its timeout support to specify a lower level of granularity. Prior ZOS releases supported timeout in minutes, the shortest value being 1 minute. However, that was even too long a time for resources to be held. With IMS version 10 and with ZOS 1.7, the timeout capability is provided in the first parameter of the APPC IoT keyword, or in the slash change APPC timeout command, allows a value that can be specified in seconds. So your granularity now has changed dramatically from being in minutes to in seconds. And again, refer to the manuals for the specific keywords you need within the DFS DC ProcLive member for the APPC IoT keyword, or for the syntax of the change APPC timeout command. Support for the lock and unlock commands. Previously, there was a restriction in sending the lock and the unlock commands from either APPC or OTMA clients. This has now been lifted. The support allows the database, program, and transaction keywords, but restricts the use of the L-term, P-term, and node keywords. The commands themselves are not changed, It's just that APPC and OTMA clients now are allowed to use those commands for the database program and transaction keywords. So you can have your APPC and OTMA clients issuing those commands. Local LU. The APPC IMS support, which was introduced in IMS version 4, which was a fair time ago, provided the ability to define both a primary VTAM LU name associated with IMS, as well as multiple secondary LU names. The primary name is known as the base LU, and the alternate names as local LUs. The base LU is specified in the APPC PM member of the sys1.proclive member used at IPL time. The local LU is the name of the alternate LUs that can be associated with an APPC IMS system. And each LU must be unique to an IMS system within the IMS Plex. IMS version 10 now enables IMS applications that use the TP PCB or the Alt PCB for APPC asynchronous outbound requests to specify which LU name to use on the outbound allocate request. And that's done through a new keyword in one of the descriptors. I'm not going to go into any more detail on that just now, but just know that there's more functionality, more granularity within the APPC functionality for outbound conversations. So if your IMS application wants to go outbound with APPC, there's some more functionality to provide more flexibility in that manner. So, to summarize this, the benefits, there's enhanced timeout capability, which will release the resources and any locks held by the IMS applications more responsively, especially if 1 minute is too long a timeout period. It will support the lock and the unlock command, allowing you the ability of having the APPC clients and OTMA clients. Pardon me. Oh, I've got another telephone ringing right beside me. They'll go away in a second. Support for the lock and the unlock command from APPC and OTMA clients. And it provide greater control of the LU names that IMS uses for asynchronous outbound requests with the local LU capability. And this will help enhance the security environment. The next part of the transaction manager section is the removal of VTAM support. Out of curiosity, does anybody out there know whether they're still using any VTAM devices?
I want to know the local command is for DB level or record level.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question. Could you repeat it, please?
Yes. I want to know the lock and the unlock command is for the DB level or for the record level.
The lock and the unlock commands are related to the lock and the unlock commands. You can lock and unlock a number of different items, but within from an APPC or an OTMA client, the new functionality allows it to occur for database, program, and transaction keywords only.
You mean items? What does the items mean? Sorry.
You can, from a normal 3270 terminal or from your master terminal, you can lock items such as databases, programs, and transactions, or even L terms and nodes, so that they cannot be used if you have a reason to do that. So that's what the lock and the unlock does. It locks it so that those items can't be used. So what this functionality now allows is that for some of those keywords only, you can do that from an APPC client.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. VTAM support, the removal of VTAM support. IBM VTAM products were withdrawn from service a number of years ago, but IMS continued to support VTAM through to the IMS, the end of IMS version 9. So IMS version 10 removes BTEM support. It will ignore all macro statements associated with the unsupported BTEM terminals during the IMS system definition. You'll get an error message or a warning message, G411, saying the macro statement associated with an unsupported BTEM terminal. So it will recognize that it's for a BTEM terminal and will tell you that. And a severity code of 2 is issued to allow the system definition to continue. So it won't stop your IMS gen from running, but you will get some warning messages, and to remove those, you'll need to remove the macros. Devices such as spool, reader, printer, punch, tape, and disk are not affected. So there are a lot of sites that use a BTAM-like spool definition for their secondary master console log. That's still quite valid, but any real BTAM devices, such as a list of them within the notes, such as a 1050, 2740, and there's a whole swag of them that I won't list, but they're all in the notes. All those devices are no longer usable with IMS version 10. Can I also just add, and this isn't in the notes, and I only found this out a day or two ago, in running an IMS gen for an IMS version 9 system, which still supports BTAM, we had to run a Nucleus gen against an IMS system, and it had a BTAM device in it. This was running on a ZOS 1.9 system, and the macro that the IMS Stage 2 gen was requiring no longer exists in ZOS 1.9. And so we had to actually remove it out because of the ZOS upgrade, not because of the IMS upgrade. So although it's not part of the IMS upgrade, just be aware if you still have BTAM devices and you're upgrading your operating system up to ZOS 1.9, you may have an issue. So from a migration consideration perspective, there's a list, I'm not going to read them, there's a list of all the macros that previously supported BTAM, and all those macros may need to be altered or changed if you have any BTAM devices left within them. And that brings me to the end of the transaction manager section, and I'm going to give control back to Jeff.
Thank you very much for that. Now let me pull up the next session. So we're at number 10, database announcements. Oops, wrong one.
Okay, you should have control back again now.
Thank you. Let me just pull up the there they are. Let me set the slideshow up. Might be a moment.
While Jeff's doing that, any questions at all on the Transaction Manager section, or indeed any of the sections from yesterday, once you've had a chance to think about them? On the screen.
Good. Okay, so now this next section that we have, thank you for your patience there. The next section that we have is talking about the enhancements we've made to the full function database part of IMS. What we've done here is made a number of usability enhancements. This is specifically on the full function side, full function MLDB side, that just make it a little easier to use or a bit of extra function available. The databases are compatible between version 8 and version 9 and version 10 completely. So you can continue, there's no migration of the databases required specifically when you move to the new systems, to IMS 10. On the database side, there are some sort enhancements that are used when we do change accumulation and the prefix resolution, and that will make the sort a lot more efficient. We have some exploitation in the ACB gen of storage above the 16 meg line. There's some enhancements to the utility to do rebuilds of HALDB indexes and the ILDS, the indirect list data set. Image copy 2, fast replication, as well as fuzzy user image copy support. So these are the five pieces that we have with on the database side. The change accumulation prefix resolution and prefix resolution sort. In the past, when we change accumulation and prefix resolution need to sort segments from the change accumulation logs or change accumulation data sets or the unload data sets in the case of prefix resolution. And we needed to sort those segments, sort those records in the data set. And in the past, what we've done is use a default sort size of 200K. Now, in days gone by, 200K was a reasonable amount of memory to be used, but given the size of databases these days, what we've done is changed that default from 200K to max. So whatever the maximum default installation value is for the sort is what you will get. So that will make your change accumulations run more quickly and any database prefix resolution jobs that you've got run a lot more quickly. Now, by it will also take a little bit more memory, and so it will be worth checking to see what the default maximum is for sort for your installation. But the intention here is just to make it to shorten the elapsed time of those utilities. The next thing we have is ACB using some more storage above the line. Previous releases of IMS put each PCB in an ACB in below-the-line storage. Now, that limited the number of PSBs to an ACB to approximately 500. Otherwise, if you had too many more than that, that would result in system 80A bins, which is just I've run out of memory. IMS version 10 ACB gen now allocates most of its working storage above the 16 meg line. Now, that will eliminate these out-of-storage bins and allow you to go up to 2,500 databases per PSB. Now, for those of you that have very large applications, an example of that would be the integrated banking application or Hogan. Having up to 2,500 PCBs per PSB is certainly going to be of value. Either way, it still gives you some value whether you're using large numbers of databases per PSB or not. There is the HALDB ILDS rebuild enhancement. Now, the HALDB index or the ILDS rebuild utility, which is DFS PREC0, PREC0, will rebuild a HALDB index or the indirect list data set for you. Now, there are new options in there. What we'll do is it will store those segments in a data space. We will sort the data in the data space and then write those ILDS, write those entries to the ILDS sequentially in load mode. That will avoid CI and CA splits and make it significantly faster when executing PREC0. So the intention here, you'll use some more memory because you'll be loading data into a data space, but you'll get faster execution when rebuilding an ILDS, and free space may improve the performance of subsequent database reorganizations because you'll have fewer CI and CA splits. The next piece we have for you is the image copy 2 fast replication. Now, this is image copy 2 is one of our image copy utilities. What we're doing is using the underlying hardware, the enterprise storage server, as well as the DS8000 devices, to provide very fast image copy via the image copy 2 utility. Now, it prereqs, it requires ZOS 1.8 and a storage subsystem that supports either dataset level flash copy version 2 or snapshot. If you do have that hardware, then what you'll get is a far faster image copy of the database with the image copy 2 utility. So we've also enhanced the database recovery utility, so it's able to read those fast replication image copies, and we've updated updated the support in DBRC so that you can use that quickly and easily as well. I won't go through the details of how to do that, but if you do have that hardware, it's going to be a lot faster because it exploits the underlying firmware, the underlying software in the DASD subsystem. That supports both clean and as well as fuzzy image copies. So fuzzy user image copies. A fuzzy image copy is one that is taken, image copy that is taken while the database is being updated. We call it a fuzzy image copy because we can't restore it without using a full forward recovery and applying the database logs to it as well, because the database is being updated at the time of the image copy. Now, in the past, we haven't had DBRC support for fuzzy user image copies. So a fuzzy user image copy is an image copy, a fuzzy image copy, taken by a tool or a utility without a DBRC interface. Examples would be pack dump, DFSMS, DSS dump, or a copy not invoked by image copy to, and so on. What we've done is add support so that you can notify a utility of DBRC a user image copy, and you can specify it's a fuzzy user image copy, where we've got the CIC and the stop time parameters used. GenDAC on recov can then be used to generate recovery from the logs after that fuzzy image copy has been restored. So it's up to you then to restore that fuzzy image copy and then do a GenDAC or recov to tell DBRC to generate the job that will do the forward recovery of the database after you've done that restore. So I'll leave the details of that for another time. But the benefit is, you know, we've got extended support for fuzzy image copies now. And so having that DBRC support means that it's provided in a better supported environment. We can always go back now to DBRC to register those image copies and then JCL support, gen JCL support for selecting the appropriate logs to recover from. So those are the database enhancements we've made to IMS version 10. Any questions on those?
Yes, I had a question.
Sure.
This is regarding the usage of core is equal to max parameter.
Sir, could you repeat that? It's regarding the...
Regarding core equal to max.
Oh, yes.
Can we code it in version 9?
Now, there are parameters... I'm thinking out loud. There are parameters that allow you to specify how much sort is to be used for the change accumulation. So you would need to change the execution of the utility to include those new parameters to say use this much storage for the sort. Version 10 will pick that up automatically by default. And many of our customers do increase the amount of storage used or the amount of sort workspace used up from the default.
Jeff, in one of our jobs, I observed that we have used core equal to max, but still we are running on IMS 9 only. We have not upgraded to version 10. So what would be the result if we use this?
That's a good question. So you were explicitly putting in core equals max in the change accumulation job?
Yes.
Then I would expect that it would pick it up. I mean, if you didn't put in core equals max in the change accum, you would pick up the default, but you've explicitly overridden the default. So I imagine that you're already doing what this version 10 enhancement is providing.
Okay.
So, yeah, as I mentioned, it's possible to override the default, and you've done that, which will make your change accumulation run a little faster than it did in the past.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question. Okay, now next is FastPath enhancements. And let me set up FastPath. Okay, you should now have the FastPath enhancements piece on the screen. We have made a number of changes in the FastPath area. We have, in five particular areas, we have made some command enhancements, some shared VSO enhancements, some capacity, some usability, and some enhancements in the expedited message handler area. On the command side, it's possible now with this, with the update command, to start all areas when starting a DDB. Now, the way that you do that is issue the update command, update database, the name of the database, start bracket access, and then area bracket asterisk will then cause IMS to start all areas of that database. Now, you can't use this command to start a specific area, but you can use this command to start all of the areas for the particular database. All right. If you wish to start individual areas with the update command, you can use the update area command. But you would need one of those commands for each area that you wanted to update. So this is just a shorthand way of allowing you to start all areas for a particular FastPath database at the same time. The next piece, there's an option now. Well, in the past, whenever the last database using the randomizer for all of the databases goes away, then we will unload that randomizer from memory. And then when the database is started again, we will load that randomizer back in. There is an option in version 10 to keep a randomizer resident in memory, even if there are no other databases using it. The reason is that we avoid the memory fragmentation from unloading and reloading the randomizers. So what we can do is issue that update command, update database, and the name of the database, stop access, and then option no rand says don't unload the randomizer from memory, please. Leave it loaded. I'm going to need that one again sometime soon. And we can therefore avoid the fragmentation in our CSA. There's a new option too for keeping the randomizer resident when stopping the database. There's a new status called STOACC, stop access, which is provided in response to a query database command indicating that the database is not accessible. It's been DBR'd or there's been an update database stop access command issued against that. There's new implications for the status of RNL, and which is a response to the query database command, indicating that the randomizer for the database is not loaded. This status previously also indicates that the database itself is not accessible. So the benefit, you can see that the stop access and the randomizer loaded separately indicate that the database is not accessible or that the randomizer is not loaded. So those are some of the first pieces of changes to FastPath. For those of you that are using shared VSO, the shared virtual storage option, the virtual storage option places an area of your data entry database in memory for very fast access. You can either have it as non-shared, in which case you'll be using a data space, or you can have it as a shared. If it's a shared database, then it will be allocated into a structure in the coupling facility. That's shared VSO. What we've done is that we need to use private buffer pools when we access the database through a shared VSO. In previous releases for single area structures, the look-aside parameter must be specified in two different places. It must be specified in DBRC as well as the DDB statement and our DFS VSM buffer allocation member. If both specifications are provided, then the DBRC value is used. With version 10, the look-aside specification in the DDB statement is not required. Now, if you've had multiple area structures, we've always ignored that DBRC specification. The benefit, we no longer need to specify that same buffer look-aside parameter in two different places and potentially have it different in each of those two places. Shared VSO, if you're using XRF, the Extended Recovery Facility, and XRF, and FDBR, then the tracking systems, the XRF tracking systems and the FAST database recovery system. I'm sorry, yes, a question?
Pleasure, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, if you're using XRF or the FAST database recovery, they did not compress any shared VSO private pools. Those pools could expand and take more memory, would never contract, and therefore you would be potentially always increasing the amount of space available to those. In version 10, both the XRF tracking systems and the FDBR systems will compress those shared VSO private pools, and it'll be done when the extended space is not used for two system checkpoints. That will reduce the amount of ECSA required for your XRF tracking system or your FAST database recovery system. Next is the start area global enhancement. We use the start area command to start an area of a FastPass databases. If we have if it's in VSO and it has the pre-open attribute set, the pre-open will now occur on all systems rather than just the one system in which that the database was opened. So when we do a start area global, we will actually start that area on all systems. If the pre-open attribute is set, then we will load that into, we will do the pre-open of the area in each of the sharing IMSs. For preload areas, the sharing systems will in fact then preload their buffer pool. So the benefit, it simplifies operations for systems using data sharing. The same activities will happen on all of the IMSs sharing that area rather than just for the one in which the command was issued. We've also added quite a deal of capacity enhancements to IMS version 10 for the FastPath buffers. The maximum number of FastPath buffers in prior releases was 65,535. Now, that was a largish number, except that more and more customers are using larger numbers of regions and larger numbers of BMPs, and with the faster processors and the more processors available on the systems these days, we're finding that 65,000 buffers is just not enough. So we dramatically increase that. The limit these days is 4 billion by FastPass buffers. Now, I'd like to be the one that sold you a machine that had that much memory, but you can, notionally at least, allocate that many buffers, 4 billion buffers, to each of your IMS version 10 systems. Some log records have been modified to accommodate this new maximum, so IMS will maintain that number of buffers in now a 4x4 word. The intention here is that FastPath can now use the larger capacities of faster processors and increased numbers of processors and therefore greater amounts of workload being put through the system. Similarly, we've increased the maximum number of FastPath output threads. We use the FastPath output threads to write any database changes back to the database themselves. In the past, the number of output threads had a maximum of 255, and although the output thread could not exceed the max PST value. In version 10, maximum number of FastPath output threads, the number of buffers that we can write in parallel back to the DASY, is now 32,767. Again, we've put this in there so that FastPath can use the larger capacities of our new processors, more processors and faster processors as well. Now, FDBR, the Fast Database Recovery, also has a FastPath buffers equals value, and that has a default The parameter in your DFS SDR member controls the location where in memory we're going to put those FastPath buffers. In previous releases, FastPath buffer equals local placed the FastPath buffers, which is the DBFCONT0 module, as well as any HSSP, high-speed sequential processing, and high-speed reorg HSRE buffers in extended private. Now, and that was the recommended way. The default, though, was to put those blocks into ECSA. The version 10, FastPath buffer equals local is the default, but it will put those now into extended private, which is the preferred place to put that. FastPath buffer equals ECSA places these modules and buffers in ECSA, which is not a recommended option. So we can now move those FastPath blocks and buffers away from ECSA and put them in private, extended private. That means that IMS FastPath can play better when your system is being shared with DB2 and KIX systems, as is often the case. So it will reduce the amount of memory being used for ECSA and replace that with storage being used in extended private instead. Certainly this is something many of our customers have been looking for because of the increasing memory used by KIX and DB2 systems, as IMS systems as well. On the usability side, in the VSAM, DFS VSAM member, we have a specification for QuitCI. Now, QuitCI is a parameter to the SDEP, the Sequential Dependent Segment Scan and Delete utility, and the QuitCI says for a sharing set of subsystems, we need to flush out everything that you're currently using out of the DASD so that the Scan and Delete utilities can read those SDEP segments from the database itself. If SDEP CI equals is not specified, the utility, its control statement itself, determines the use of QuitCI, but in the future you can specify it in your DFS VSM member, and therefore there's no need to put it at the scan and delete utility parameter level. You can do it at the subsystem level instead. And that can be used to enforce the use of QuitCI to make sure that all of the SDEPs that have been captured are actually written out to the DASY before those utilities are executed. We also have some expedited message handler enhancements in IMS version 10. Every now and again, fortunately quite rarely, but every now and again, a FastPath terminal in response mode will require an IMS restart to clear it or a complex series of commands in order to clear it. IMS 10 allows hung nodes and users to be reset, that FastPath response mode to be reset without bringing IMS down. It applies to input response mode and output response mode with either local or shared EMH. And the command stop node, start node, or stop user, start user for dynamic users can be issued at any time. But we now will display if the terminal or user is hung in response mode with the new status response input FastPath mode. So we can now clear that with commands far more quickly and easily than we could in the past. So those are the changes we made to FastPath. We made some enhancements to the commands, the improved update database and query database. We improved the use of ECSA. We simplified the definition with shared VSO. We provided increased capacity, significant increased capacity, with the output threads and the buffers, and improved the use of ECSA, and then the simple enforcement of QuitCI for the SDEP scan and delete utilities, as well as the ability to reset your FastPath response mode. So any questions on the FastPath changes that we've made?
One question, Jim.
Sure.
May I know, can you please tell me about this ECSA fragmentation, what it is?
Yep. Oh, okay. ECSA is the extended common service area, and it's an area of memory in your Z-series machine. The randomizer is a routine that takes the key, like Jeff Nichols, and says, I'll randomize that into the address where Jeff Nichols' segment is going to be stored in the database. Now, if you unload and load and unload and load the randomizer regularly, then you can, the amount of memory that's been used can get fragmented. I need a little bit more here, it won't fit over there, so I may, and so the memory will get, some of it will be used, some of it not used. So by leaving the randomizer loaded, we've stopped that fragmentation. And that's our goal there, is to eliminate the fragmentation. If the memory gets fragmented, then other programs are not going to be able to run because they don't have enough contiguous memory to be able to get the storage they need, and therefore those programs will fail. So that's what we're trying to avoid.
So is this going to affect the performance?
No, not at all. It doesn't matter where the randomizer is loaded, as long as it is loaded. What it means is that more programs will be able to better use the available memory.
Okay, so the idea is to use memory in a better way.
It will leave the randomizer loaded in memory, and therefore will avoid the fragmentation and make better use of the memory.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so that's the FastPath enhancements. So, Robert, I guess it's your turn now to talk about number 12, connectivity enhancements.
Connectivity enhancements, yes. Let me just start that up. Can you all now see the connectivity front screen? I assume it's...
Yeah, it's coming up.
Probably slowly. Okay, the next section, and we might have a break at the end of this section, maybe. The next section covers the connectivity enhancements made with IMS version 10. There are two main areas in which these enhancements have been categorized. The first one is to do with OTMA, and the second one is to do with IMS Connect. So let's look at OTMA first. The highlights of the OTMA enhancements. They address several high availability requirements, and they include some routing enhancements that covers some destination routing descriptors and resume T-pipe security, the automatic flood detection and control of input messages, better timeout control, T-pipe storage cleanup, member level security, asynchronous message enhancements, and enhanced OTMA display information. So they're the topics that we're going to cover under OTMA enhancements. So let's start off with the routing enhancements. Prior to IMS version 10, IMS systems that enabled OTMA and also produced alt PCB output messages for external destinations required system programmers to code several OTMA routing exits, including DFSY-PRX0 and DFSY-DRU0. This requirement often inhibited or delayed the adoption of new connectivity implementations, such as IMS Connect. So IMS version 10 introduces new OTMA destination routing descriptors that can eliminate the requirement to code the exits by externalizing the definitions and specifications that the exits provide. If the exits do exist, they will be called for the routing information provided. Additionally, these descriptors have the ability to route from OTMA to non-OTMA destinations such as SNA printers and terminals, and there's future support for MQ under consideration. And down the bottom of the screen there, it also says it provides the OTMA support for the call-out function. Any questions on that? Okay. Resume T-pipe security. This addresses the security exposure currently seen with any asynchronous output messages retrieved by a resume tpipe request. IMS transactions and commands that flow through OTMA from various clients are protected by current security RACF classes, be they TIMS or CIMS. The responses are guaranteed to be delivered to the client that initiated the transaction or the command. Output messages in the hold queue that are generated as a result of asynchronous processing, so you've got some asynchronous process here that's going to send a message out, there is no protection by any security class, because the security was basically set as the input of the message in the other cases. When these messages are retrieved by an OTMA client using the resume tpipe, a security exposure can occur. The function provided by the resume tpipe security protects these output messages by establishing a security class named RIMS within RACF or other security product. Within this class, the security definitions are associated with the tpipe name, along with the list of user IDs or group names under that tpipe. Therefore, it allows the installations to optionally authorize the user ID together with the tpipe name that is contained in the resume tpipe command. So you now have a new RACF class available, where the default one is RIMS. So in the IMS DFS DC parameter member, or in the IMS stage 1, there's an R class parameter, and whatever that value is, you put an R in front of it, and that's the RACF class that is going to be looking for this feature. And you can control the tpipe name and the user ID for the resume tpipe functionality. In addition, there's a new exit routine, DFS YRTUX, that's invoked after the call to RACF or other product, regardless of the result, and you've got the option of using this exit to code more functionality into the security if you choose to. Message flood detection and control. We have the capability that now automatically monitors the growth of active input messages. It sets a default maximum threshold of 5,000 active messages, and if the IMS system has more than 5,000 unscheduled, unprocessed or orphaned input messages from OTMA member, then any new input message from that same member is rejected. Why would we do this? Well, this uses up additional storage for each one of these messages, and if you let it go uncontrolled, it can eventually lead to a system 4.0 dog event due to a large number of OTMA control blocks associated with these requests. So this limitation is designed to avoid the 4.0D event due to the large numbers. This functionality is already available in IMS version 8 and version 9. The APAR numbers are on your screen. So if you're running IMS 8 and IMS 9 and you do want this functionality, please ensure that those particular APARs have been implemented. Okay, send then commit to timeout control, or CM1. There's some new timeout control capability for send then commit interactions. For sync level equals confirm or sync level equals sync point processing, IMS will wait for the ACK or NAC after sending the response. Now, this could lead to a wait sync point or a wait for RRS status, as it sends the message and it has to wait for the acknowledgement to come back, so the IMS transaction has to wait. And while that's happening, the locks are held and the dependent region is occupied, not available for use by any other transaction. There's some new backout logic new backout logic implements some timeout capability for this. And if the ACK or NAC is not received within a time limit, and the default value is 120 seconds, it will then time out. The next screen is tpipe storage cleanup. This enhancement releases unused storage. and will allow the removal of unused T-pipes from the storage buffer pools. IMS will determine that a T-pipe is unused if it has been idle for two consecutive checkpoints. The T-pipe is similar to an L-term within an OTMA implementation. This capability is also available on IMS version 8 and IMS version 9 with the relevant APARs implemented. This will just do a bit of storage cleanup if you're a heavy user of OTMA. The next topic is member level security. There's a new secure OTMA command option that will now allow OTMA members to define its own security setting. Prior to IMS version 10, OTMA security was a system-wide setting for all OTMA members. You would set it via the OTMA SE startup parameter, and then you could optionally change it by the / secure OTMA command. But that command and the startup options applied to the entire IMS system and all OTMA members. I haven't seen any information about the OTMA SE parameter and what happens at IMS startup, but certainly you can change it from the default at startup and be unique for any particular OTMA member if you choose to do so. And each one independently can be full, check, none, or profile, which are the four options that currently exist. Please note that if you have changed it dynamically, any messages that are processed with the security level before the change was in effect will continue to use that security level until their processing has been completed. Asynchronous message enhancements. For asynchronous messages, that's commit then send messages, CM0, or messages undelivered IOPCB and all old PCB messages, it now has super member capability. It facilitates the delivery of the asynchronous messages by any instance within a set of IMS connects and IMS subsystems. With this function, affinity to a particular IMS or IMS connect is removed, and the use of shared queues and other shared queues solutions become more viable. So this provides a bit more functionality within a shared queues environment for people wanting asynchronous CM0 messages. A little bit more detail on this. The super member capability, it facilitates the delivery of IMS asynchronous messages. So you have a set of OTMA clients running in a Sysplex, and then you have multiple instances of IMS Connect, and they can now support load balancing of or IP spraying solutions such as Sysplex Distributor. This is only done by IMS systems in a shared queues environment, and they can have multiple front-end and back-end IMS systems, and it will remove the affinity to a particular IMS. And as per some of the other enhancements, this is also available in prior releases. With IMS version 8, there are some APARs required, and for IMS Connect version 2.2, which is still available as part of, to run alongside of IMS version 8 and an APAR for that, or for IMS version 9 and the integrated IMS Connect, the attached three APARs. Reroute and purge support. For OTMA hold queue capable clients only, OTMA members such as IMS Connect that keep asynchronous messages on the IMS message queue until requested by the remote application. So the reroute and the purge support applies to those, and it extends the support that allows remote applications to reject or request action on asynchronous messages, and they can purge from the IMS message queue or reroute to an alternate destination. When both reroute and purge are specified for a message, then neither is performed, and you get a warning message. And it will store the message in the hold queue for the inputting teapot. And again, this is also delivered in previous releases. The APARs involved in that are actually included in the notes. So that's all the OTMA enhancements, and now we're up to the IMS Connect enhancements. And there are a number of them. There's the ACEE aging value support, client password change request, RACF mixed case password support, CM1 timeout, message flood control, asynchronous message enhancement, XML adapter support, and the IMS SOA composite business application support. You might note some of those look very similar to the OTMA enhancements. They obviously work hand in hand. The ACE aging value support. For anyone who doesn't know what an ACEE stands for, it stands for the Access Control Environment Element. That's actually the control block within RACF that identifies the user ID and the attributes associated with the user ID in RACF. And when you sign on to IMS or you have to do any sort of a RACF sign-on, the ACE will be accessed, the ACEE will be accessed, and potentially loaded into storage while the transaction is in flight. So we now have a new OAAV parameter in the data store statement of the IMS Connect configuration file. And this can specify the ACE aging value in seconds. And there's an example of it, data store ID equals, and one of the values is OAAV equals 360. That would mean 360 seconds. There's a comment there that any value between 0 and 300 are set to 300. So effectively 300 seconds is the minimum. The OTMA aging value can be displayed when you issue the view HWS or view data store command, or you use the MVS modify command query member and query data store output. And there's an example. Client password change request. IMS Connect now provides a new mechanism that allows a remote client to request that RACF or equivalent passwords associated with a user ID can be changed. This new capability will be supported in the current IMS Connect exits, HWS SMPL0, HWS SMPL1, and HWS Java 0 in all those exit routines. Those routines will check for a leading keyword of HWS PWCH, and this will determine whether it is a request to change the password. So it's just simply a keyword string of HWS PWCH0, which will determine that there's a password change requested. This string can be viewed as a transaction code, but new logic in the routine is called to process the special request. And those exits mentioned above can be modified to define the HWS PWCH constant with a unique keyword value other than that. So you can possibly change what the value is. And it tells you there on the screen you just need to include HWS PWCH0 when you're linking or binding the exits in JCL. So you now have the ability of changing your password from the client end. RACF mixed case password support. Just like IMS version 10 itself, within IMS Connect it can now support mixed case passwords. Obviously this needs to be enabled within ZOS first. So on the IMS Connect configuration member, HWSCFG, is a new parameter called PSW DMC, and that can be a yes or a no. No being the default. I'm just trying to see if I can see what the... There it is. Just going back to my notes here. PSW DMC equals N is the default, and the setting can be changed using an IMS connect set PWMC or update command. And that can turn it on or off. So you can see examples of various commands there. The IMS connect command, or the IMS connect update command, and it requires that the RACF support is enabled by the RACF set ROPS for mixed case. So if you want to have mixed case passwords, you now can. Send then commit timeout control. This is the capability of CM1 interactions to support the associated function in OTMA that we talked about before and resolves the wait sync point and wait RRS situation. There's a new parameter in the data store statement of the IMS Connect configuration file called ACKTO and can be set to between 0 and 255 seconds. The default in OTMA is 120. If it's specified as 0, it automatically gets reset to 120, or the value that's specified in OTMA. If it's outside the 0 to 255 range, it's reset also to the OTMA value. And it's not accepted if the value is greater than the value in the OTMA. So it's got to be at least the same or lower than the value in OTMA. Message flood control. Here IMS Connect takes advantage of the OTMA message flood control capability that we spoke about earlier to automatically monitor the growth of active input messages. OTMA provides a default value of 5,000, after which input messages for a specific IMS Connect instance will be rejected. If provided an override value in the max I parameter of the IMS Connect configuration data store statement is passed to OTMA. And again, there's a number of different combinations of what values will take precedence. If within IMS Connect you specify the value as 0, it's automatically reset to 5,000. If you specify something between 0 and 200, it's reset to 200. If it's between 9,999 and 65,000, it's reset back to 9,999. Otherwise, you'll get in a bend. This is not accepted if the value is greater than the value in OTMA set by the descriptor of the command. So if you're going to set this value and the OTMA message flood control value, best thing is to refer to the manuals and just coordinate the two values to be appropriate for what you're trying to achieve. Asynchronous message enhancements, again for CM0. These are all detailed in the OTMA section that we talked about before. So the topics in both the IMS Connect and under OTMA, and just refers to the previous note. So if you do want to do something around this area, refer to the notes and or refer to the manuals, but be aware that there are some enhancements here to asynchronous message processing. XML adapter support. The XML adapter support opens up IMS Connect to receive and recognize messages containing XML tags, provide the conversion into a message format for IMS, including the EBCDIC translation if needed, receive IMS application reply messages that do not contain XML tags, and to perform the conversion to XML, and again, any EBCDIC to Unicode translation. This support's also have been made available in IMS version 9 by the two APARs mentioned on the screen. So you could have an IMS Connect client, such as the IMS SOAP Gateway, which can send an XML message with a request for translation, and IMS Connect can now invoke this XML adapter and do all the translation for you. making life much simpler if you want to use this functionality. The IMS SOA Composite Business Application Support. This is a new capability for the IMS TM Resource Adapter client that invokes IMS conversational transactions. The IMS TM Resource Adapter, which was formerly known as IC4J, that could be running in a WebSphere application server, can take advantage of either dedicated or shareable persistent sockets. A dedicated persistent socket remains dedicated to a particular user for a commit-then-send CM0 interaction until it's released by the client application. Shareable persistent sockets, on the other hand, can be shared by multiple applications in the WebSphere server running either send-then-commit, CM1, or CM0, commit-then-send interactions. The IMS TM Resource Adapter client does not have control of the socket that's used in this case. So you can have different sockets and different combinations of sockets being used here. And that, I think, nicely brings us to about the halfway mark, Jeff. That's the end of the transaction, the communication section.
Yep, good. Okay, let's take a 5-minute stretch break.
Yep.
And we'll come back with the connectivity enhancements, my integration suite enhancements.
The integration one, yes.
Yeah, integration suite enhancements. What we've got for the rest of the day is the integration suite, which is the IMS Cert Gateway and the TM Resource Adapter and so on. And I'll tap dance over the top of those and do those fairly lightly. We've got some DBRC bits and pieces, and then we'll talk about migration from IMS 8 or IMS 9 through to IMS 10. Okay, so let's take 5 minutes. Thanks. Good afternoon again, ladies and gentlemen. Let's keep going. We have a deal more material still to be covered before we finish up today. I will be taking us through the next two sessions. The first of those is the IMS Integration Suite Enhancements. The Integration Suite being the TM Resource Adapter, the IMS Database Resource Adapter, the MFS Web Enablement, and the IMS SOAP Gateway bits and pieces. After that, I'll talk to you about the changes that we made to DBRC with version 10, including the parallel recon access. And then Robert will finish up with the IMS migration. So I'm hoping actually to spend most of that time on the migration because it's a piece that you will all no doubt be doing as your customers and migrate from IMS versions 8 or 9 through to IMS version 10. So let me start up the piece for the integration enhancements. And let me go across and make sure you can see it as well. Okay, so you should now have up the slide for the IMS Integration Suite Enhancements. Is that coming through?
Yeah, I've just got it.
Yeah, good. Okay. So what we have... Oh, it's not coming up the way I want it. Let me just... Hang on. Let me set that up again. Sorry about that. Okay, so we should be good again now. All right, so the IMS Integration Suite enhancements. The IMS Integration Suite is the name we've used for a number of tools that allow you to view your IMS systems as participants in a service-oriented architecture environment. What it does is allows you to access your IMS transactions and IMS databases as services in an SOA environment. So this is the tooling that we've provided over the last couple of years, specifically to make it easier to for your non-mainframe customers to get at the IMS transactions, as I say, as well as directly to the IMS databases. Now, the pieces that we'll go through now, what I'll do for each of these is just give you a brief introduction to what the TM Resource Adapter is, the SOAP Gateway is, and so on, and give you a brief introduction to some of the bits and pieces that we've done through there. Now, the changes that we've made to each of these have been driven by customer requirements. So if you find that you are using the TM Resource Adapter or the SOAP Gateway and it doesn't do exactly what you're hoping it will do, then please send an email through to myself or to Robert or to someone in IMS development. And what we'll do is work with you to try and get these pieces, get those changes made into the system. Because there's a great deal of work happening across the IMS Integration Suite. So let me start off then with the IMS TM Resource Adapter. The IMS TM Resource Adapter is a set of tools that we provide, and they're provided free of charge, and they can be downloaded off the IMS homepage. They're provided to allow you to very quickly and easily get access to your IMS transactions. So over, let me pull up my trusty pen. So over the side here we have our IMS system, and we have the OTMA piece there, and the IMS Connect giving us the TCP/IP access into it. So in the blue side over on the right here, we have our existing IMS transactions. Now, with some of the tools that we have, I've lost my, there it is. So with some of the tools that we have over here, we've highlighted there RAD, the Rational Application Developer, WID, the WebSphere Integration Developer, and the WebSphere Developer for Z-Series, we now call the Rational Developer for Z-Series. Those are development tools that allow you to take the definition of what goes into and comes out of your IMS transaction, either in COBOL or PL1 or C, and then using the wizards in create the pieces that you need to be able to run programs under WebSphere Application Server that allow you access to those transactions. So you have your existing IMS transactions. Let me put some color. So what we have is some existing transactions happening over here, and then through TCP/IP, we can have access to those from applications running under the WebSphere application server. Now, those Java applications will call the TM resource adapter, which will then make the connection through to IMS Connect and pass that transaction through to IMS. And it makes it very simple and very easy for those IMS transactions to be accessed via web services under WebSphere application server. We continue to enhance the function provided through the TM resource adapter over time. So prior to IMS version 10, we added more support than was originally made available with IMS version 9. Now, the cycle of changes typical to an IMS environment is every 2 to 3 years we come out with a new release of IMS. So between when we announced and made available IMS version 9 2 years ago and IMS version 10 in October of last year, we've made a number of changes. The first of those is to use PL1 source as the way to define through to the wizards what the input data is and what the output data is to your IMS transactions. We also provided commit mode 1 sync level confirm support through the IMS TM resource adapter. We also made available the ability to retrieve output using an alternate client ID when you are using shareable persistent sockets, as well as some enhanced SSL cipher configurability through the system as well. The first of those, the PL1 source message structures, what we do is that with the tool, we provide the input and the output definition of what goes into our IMS transaction and the data that comes out of our IMS transaction. Now, at first release, we only provided support for COBOL. Now, with this release, we've also provided support, support for PL1. So we provide now support for PL1, and then the tooling, the RAD tooling over at the site here, will read the PL1 description of the data in and the data out, and then the wizards will generate the pieces that you need for that. The advantage, it simplifies building the Java data bindings for your IMS PL1 application programs, where in the past you've always been able to do it with COBOL. And we've, of course, added C in that mix as well. Sync level confirm and commit mode 1 using persistent shareable persistent sockets. Commit mode 1, which is send then commit, is only supported using a shareable persistent socket. The TM resource adapter uses persistent socket connections to communicate with IMS Connect, and that connection prevents the overhead of opening and closing the socket for use by the application. So we've avoided a lot of the overhead and of creation and tearing down of those socket connections, and therefore we can get higher performance and throughput through the system. The TM resource adapter provides two types of persistent socket connections, a dedicated one and a shareable persistent one. The dedicated one is restricted to commit mode 0. The shareable persistent one is available with commit mode 0 and commit mode 1, which is the send and commit protocol. Right. What we've done is that we've provided a new set of wizards through the new releases of the Rational Application Developer. So what happens then is that the TM resource adapter sends an ACK, and then we get a send and commit, a commit mode 1 timeout control. The advantage of it is that the TM resource adapter can notify IMS that it's received the IMS application output message without requiring a global transaction, and reduces the need of a compensating transaction in case the response was not received. The TM Resource Adapter is still compatible with APPC sync-level support. This is a busy diagram. Let me take it through from the top. Our Java client at the side here says, I'm going to generate a request through to IMS, and so it will send through a request through to the IMS TM Resource Adapter, which will send through IMS Connect to IMS a transaction to get processed. Our application program will process that and put a message back onto the queue. Now, we don't ever send a response back to our initial Java client number one. Java client number two says, well, I know that request has gone in, let me go and get it. So Java client number two down the bottom here sends in another request through to the TM Resource Adapter, which will send in a request to IMS itself, which will cause another application program to rerun to get those messages and pass them back. So what our second Java client here can do is get the output messages that have been initiated from that initial Java client number one. So we can retrieve that output using an alternate client ID. We can retrieve the output generated from the first request from a separate program, an alternate client ID. The implementation requires an APAR to some maintenance to IMS Connect. Only single wait and single no wait options are supported, but the benefit is we can use that shareable persistent socket to retrieve asynchronous output, and it makes it easier to write our IMS Connector for Java client programs. We also have enhanced SSL cipher configurability. We now have the ability to put the e-null value for the encryption type. In the past, we've had two different encryption types which allow us to encrypt it all or not encrypt it all. E-null says, I'm going to encrypt some of it, but some of it's going to be in the clear because it's really only, It's not a piece of information that we really need to encrypt and for security. It can go through in the clear successfully. So the TM Resource Adapter, we've made a number of changes to the TM Resource Adapter for IMS version 10 as well. We have asynchronous callout support to an enterprise Java bean or a message-driven bean. We have the ability, as Robert mentioned earlier, to change RECF passwords using the IMS TM Resource Adapter and IMS Connect. We have the ability to provide information back to the Enterprise Workload Manager, policy-based performance management. Then we have support for the SOA composite business applications, and we have commit mode zero using multiple purge calls. So let me just talk quickly about each of those bits and pieces. Asynchronous callout. My program over here says I'm going to execute an IMS transaction on the Z series, but my transaction is going to need to get information from a client from a web service somewhere else on the network. So what we'll do is that we have this call out support, the ability to call out from my client through IMS Connect out to my enterprise Java bean, my Java application running under WebSphere application server, which will then process my request. Now, we will do it asynchronously, so that sending of the request out from my application program will happen, and then sometime later, the response will come back, and then we'll go back to a different program, which will then be able to process that. So our At this stage, we have asynchronous call-out support to an enterprise Java Bean, an IMS application program. This is a whole new piece of applications for IMS. The ability for an IMS transaction running COBOL or Java or PL1 or whatever on the host to be able to invoke a web service through this asynchronous call-out, the web service will be able to process our request and send the response back, and then we get an asynchronous response back to another application on our IMS system over here. So let me leave the TM resource adapter there and skip a few files forward to the IMS SOA composite business application support. We provide support through WebSphere Process Server and the WebSphere Integration Server. The WebSphere Integration Server, WID, is a piece of software available from IBM that allows you to integrate multiple services in an integration sense, to integrate them together. And we provide support through that for IMS. So the transactions whose input messages are defined in C, COBOL, or PL1 can then be read by the WebSphere Integration Developer software. It will create the pieces we need for the IMS TM resource adapter, which can then run under the WebSphere Process Server using the TM resource adapter to get access to IMS transactions and IMS resources. The benefit, we can provide multiple connections with IMS conversational transaction support provided through there as well. IMS is starting to work a lot more closely with all of the WebSphere application development tooling, providing access to your existing IMS transactions through the TM resource adapter in a WebSphere services-oriented architecture environment. Now, one more feature that we've added to this in IMS version 10, the ability to have multiple purge calls come through. In our IMS application down here, we insert a message to the message queue and then write the message. We insert a second message and write it with the purge call, and insert a third message and write it with a third purge call. So in our message to go back, we have segment 1, segment 2, and segment 3. Now, rather than our application on the Java end receiving output 1 and then output 2 and output 3, what we can do is that we can use the new function provided so that we can send this flag that says ignore purge call support. And so rather than sending 3 separate messages back, we will send a single message back with all 3 segments in there to make it easier to write your Java client. Let me move on now to the IMS SOAP Gateway. The IMS SOAP Gateway is a way of getting access to your IMS transactions running in your IMS system over the side here through TCP/IP, but without having a fully heavy-duty WebSphere application server environment. The IMS SOAP Gateway is a lightweight web server. It's a very small web server, and there are versions of it that run both in the Windows environment and the ZOS environment as well. There are tools available in the WebSphere Developer for Z-Series and the Rational Developer for Z-Series environment that will read the COBOL definition of the data going into and the data coming out, and then create you the pieces you need to help create the pieces for the SOAP client. And then that SOAP client can then send a request through to IMS and then get the response back again. Rather than talking through it today, if you're interested in this some more, I can demonstrate this for you. We can do this over a web conference as well. And it actually demonstrates very easily. It demonstrates probably more easily to real than it does through to PowerPoint. We have made a number of changes to this, and I won't go through the detail of those today, but the detail of them is there available in the book for you as well. The next piece to talk to is the IMS MFS web support. Again, what we have here is IMS transactions running at IMS, available through TCP/IP through IMS Connect. And then the MFS web service runs the Team Resource Adapter and uses the MFS definitions, the message format service definitions, to get the data into and out of your transaction. So you can write an enterprise Java bean that will call the MFS web service, which will then call the TM Resource Adapter to pass your request through to IMS and get processed, and then pass the response back through there as well. So we can do that with either business-to-business connections or business-to-consumer connections through a web browser as necessary. The IMS Database Resource Adapter, moving on, is a way of getting access to your IMS databases from a number of different environments. You can get access to them from the KIX environment, through JKIX, through DB2 stored procedures, as well as through WebSphere Enterprise Java Beans. Now, this is getting at your IMS databases at the IMS database level. We've made a number of changes. That function has been there for a while. Let me just go through quickly some of the changes that we've made. The first of those is the DB2 Java stored procedure returns DB2 result sets. When you access IMS databases through a DB2 stored procedure, in the past you've got the IMS data back itself. With this enhancement, what we can do is get a DB2 result set back again, which simplifies the processing of that IMS data coming back and provides data-independent processing consistent with result set processing in DB2. So those of you that have created DB2 stored procedures will be able to get the data back from your IMS database through that stored procedure in a consistent manner to what we're doing with DB2. We've also provided the Database Resource Adapter access to GSAM, the ability to use flat files through this Database Resource Adapter. So your existing Java batch processing applications will be able to get access to the GSAM databases through this support as well. There is automatic data conversion done by the Java class libraries, and it supports all of the data types to be stored into and read from your GSAM database records. Now, the last piece here is the support in the Database Resource Adapter for the IBM Java Software Development Kit version 5. Now, it contains a re-engineered Java 2 virtual machine. It's the virtual machine used to execute your Java bytecode, and it provides some significant performance benefits. The first of those, and I won't go through the detail of them all, but the first of those provides cache class sharing. Rather than each program needing to load the Java classes independently, what we'll do is cache those Java classes, much like VLA and LLF, or VLF and LLA, for your COBOL programs. We'll cache the subroutines that your programs call. We will, in this case, cache the classes required by your Java programs. And so rather than having to reread them from DASD every time, we'll be able to reread them from memory, and that makes the access to those classes and therefore the performance of your Java programs significantly faster. We do require a bit of maintenance to turn that on to get the Java class sharing. And we provide both 31-bit and 64-bit software development kits for the Java 2 technology in that version 5. So you provide significant performance as well as functional increases there as well. The DLI model utility is now GUI-based. In version 9, the DLI model utility, DLI model utility allows you to create Java JDBC definitions of your IMS databases. So your Java programmers can view your IMS databases as if they were relational style of databases. In the past, the DLI model utility was a TSO ISPF application, so a character-based utility. With version 10, we've made it a GUI-based application. So it's an Eclipse plugin, as it mentions over at the site here. So using this plugin to the Eclipse framework and the Rational Developer VZ Series framework, we can use this to take the definition of what our databases look like, our PSBs and DBDs, and create the Java classes that are required by the need by the Java programmers. So it makes it easier for Java programmers to do this. The last piece I'll talk about today is the XML database. XML database is a way of accessing your existing IMS databases over here, allowing you to view that as XML. So you'd be able to get the data from your IMS database in that XML format. In version 10, we've added XQuery support. Now, XQuery is a standard for allowing you to access information using a new style of access, and that's the XQuery access. We do have a separate class, a separate set of presentations available on this, but I won't go through that today. But it's worth remembering you can get access to your existing IMS databases as XML. You can create XML documents as shown on the diagram here. Also, you can use XQuery to make access to your existing IMS databases far faster and provide the XQuery support through that as well. So that's as much as I wish to go through right now on the IMS Integration Suite software. Are there any questions for what is, I know, a very large topic? Okay, let me move on. So, let me move on now to... DBRC, Database Recovery Control. DBRC is the diary function of IMS. It's the, I opened this database, I closed this database, I image copied this database, I recovered this database. So I think of DBRC as the diary, database recovery control, keeping track of all of the things that have happened to your database. What we've done in version 10 of IMS is are a number of incremental enhancements and some very major changes there as well. That second last one, that parallel recon access, is a very major change. And that's a very good change, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. What we've done is that we've increased the DBRC timestamp precision. In the past, the timestamp was down to the millisecond. Now it's down to the microsecond. So while we haven't changed the internal information that we're storing in DBRC, we now actually have the ability to use times in DBRC accurate down to the microsecond. Let's look at an example of that. So DBRC timestamps will be now recorded to the microsecond, or previously just to the tenth of a second. So you notice in here, we have a time, 2006.114, so the 114th day of year 2006. At 16:01:03, so 4 p.m. in the afternoon, 1 minute and 3 seconds past 4, and 1/10 of a second. Now, we have allowed you to see all of the rest of that timestamp down to the millisecond, to the microsecond. Now, you can continue to use the timestamps that you've got and the JCL and the parameters that you've got, and any values that you've not got down to that microsecond will be interpreted as zeros. But you can now also do this down to the microsecond. The reason we've done that is that the cycle time on those Z10 machines is getting so fast that we really need to keep far higher precision available to you so that you can split what's happened right down to that level. Our intention here is not necessarily that you'll use it initially, but that over the life of the next several releases of IMS, this will be necessary. So this will be giving us some breathing space for time into the future. The external timestamp format in version 8 and version 9 hasn't changed. In version 10, we now have all these extra digits right at the back end there. Any trailing digits that you've not got in some of your parameters as you've migrated from version 8 and version 9 will be assumed to be zero. Now, it's interesting to note the internal timestamp format has not changed in version 10. It continues to be exactly internally the same between 8, 9, and 10. The only difference is we now have the code in version 10 to use those last few digits of the timestamp. DBRC commands, again, you can use as many digits as necessary to identify the information. Any digits that you don't specify will be assumed to be zero. The utility control statements for change accume and database recovery have those increased timestamp fields. They may be used. It's up to you. The increased precision is not required. So that's the increased precision of the timestamps for DBRC. Are there any questions with that? Okay, let me continue on. Recon read-only access. In the past, everyone that accessed the recon required alter access at the security level to be able to read the recon datasets. That was because the utilities that we've provided to read the recon made no distinction between reading and updating. What we've done in version 10 is to provide support for four levels of dataset authority for the utilities which access the recon. So we can now specify read access is all that is required, or update access, or control access, or alter access, where alter was the only one that was required. Previous IMSs provided control or alter, needed control or alter access, and alter was required for deleting and defining information. So any users that only needed to read data from the recons required control authority and therefore could potentially update it. So what we've done in version 10 is add read-only support for the recons. You can put a palm bracket read-only on DSPURX, the DBRC command, batch command utility, and so you can say to DBRC, no, this program or this user is only allowed read access. Similarly, when you access through access to the recon through the DBRC API, then we can have a read-only equals yes parameter, and the user therefore will only require read authority to the recon, and causes the recons to be open for input rather than output. So read authority is sufficient for readers of the recon. Update authority is sufficient for all accesses except delete and define, and alter is required for delete and define. So we've got more granularity of access to the recons now. So any questions on that? IMS Plex, SCI registration. In version 9 and 8, the first DBRC to specify an IMS Plex name set that value in the recons. However, you might have made a mistake and subsequent users would be denied access to the recons. In version 10, the Plex name is only set by the change.recon-imsplexname command so that users can't mistakenly make those changes. DBRC API, the Database Recovery Control Applications Programming Enhancements. In version 9, we provided a programming interface so that programs could read information from the recon. Now, what we did was the program was able to call DBRC and then get the data from the recon, the information directly. In version 10, what we've done is provide the ability for updates. A program accessing DBRC is now going to be allowed to make updates using DBRC commands, init, change, and notify commands. You can register as a subsystem, which allows the application to authorize the database. which allows the application therefore to do utility functions. We've made a number of query enhancements to the DBRC API and a number of security enhancements there as well. Now, I don't intend going through all of these. Suffice to say, we do have the DBRC API. At version 9, we allowed only inquiry access. In version 10, you are allowed recon update capability by using DBRC commands issued through the program accessing DBRC. So you now have the ability to make changes in your recons as well. Are there any questions on the DBRC API? Okay. Let me skip through now to parallel recon access. Where do I want to start with this one? In the past, it's been necessary to in order to prevent multiple programs from accessing the recon at the same time, to lock the recon itself. And that meant, and we've typically done that through ZOS reserve level access. What we've done with version 10 is allow you to access the vSAM data files that are the recon database itself through transactional vSAM, and so we can now lock information at the record level within here rather than at the database level. What that means then is we have the ability to have multiple programs, multiple IMSs, update the recons concurrently, like it's a database. So each DBRC instance, each online subsystem, each batch job, each utility has the ability to make updates to independent parts of the recons at exactly the same time. That means then that we're going to have less of a bottleneck for access to the recons for major functions. Now, parallel recon access is optional. It's not a mandatory part of IMS version 10, and I don't believe it ever will be. But what it does, if you choose to go forward with it, is that you can reduce some of the overhead for accessing the recons. Now, I've seen some unpublished information recently that suggests that if you're opening very large numbers of databases or very large numbers of areas all at once, then using parallel recon access, we can get some very significant performance enhancements out of the system. The overhead of doing it is also negligible. The same set of commands accessing the DBRC the old way and accessing it through parallel recon access, the performance of them is very much the same. So what we're doing here is to eliminate the serialization of access to DBRC through the system. So the dataset reserve, or the global NQ, has been eliminated, which significantly reduces contention, providing potentially far better responsiveness in both your IMS online and IMS batch environment. What we do is that we have rewritten the code so that IMS itself now accesses the recons using transactional vSAM. Now, transactional vSAM is a piece of software from IBM that provides locking, logging, caching, commit for concurrent updates to the vSAM datasets. Now, you can use that separately for your own applications as well, but we're going to use it here for access to the recons, and it exploits parallel sysplex, and it requires a parallel sysplex environment through the coupling facility, and it requires transactional vSAM. Now, I must tell you that transactional vSAM is an extra cost piece of software, but some of you may already have transactional vSAM ready, in which case you can use it without extra cost. For those of you that don't have transactional vSAM and wish to use the parallel recon access, there are special pricing available to make that function available to you. So what we've done is it because we can now access the recon as a database? We don't put a reserve on it at the whole of the database level. We can now access separate records in the recon in parallel, like we can do with every vSAM database and every IMS and DB2 database. That gives us... I wonder why that time came up. That gives us increased parallelism and therefore reduced overhead in terms of access to the recons. So you're going to potentially require new operational procedures in terms of failure scenarios and recovery. And a reminder too, parallel recon access is optional. You define to the recons that they're going to use parallel recon access, and then the IMS software will do that, or you can turn it off again. And you can migrate to parallel recon access, and you can fall back quite transparently, needing a cold start to your system. The transactional vSAM is an enhancement to vSAM record level sharing, vSAM RLS. It uses locking and data caching in the coupling facilities, typically used by SIG systems to allow concurrent updates to vSAM files by multiple KIX subsystems. Now, more than that, I think I'll leave for another day. I won't go through how to define parallel recon access. I'll just say that we need to set up some IMS definitions, some recon definitions. You need to define a few bits and pieces to the SysPlex, and then you can start using parallel recon access. But it gives you increased parallelism for access to your IMS databases. So any questions on parallel recon access? I'm sure it's all very clear. Let me skip forward then to DBRC recon migration and coexistence, which in fact is starting off talking about the migration and upgrading from IMS versions 8 and 9 through to IMS 10. There are APARs, there are coexistence SPEs available to IMS version 8 and IMS version 9 that will allow each of IMS 8 and version 9 to upgrade your recon from to a version 10 format prior to implementing version 10 into production. So your IMS 8 system can read a recon formatted at version 8 or at version 9 or version 10 level. So that what you can do then is to migrate your recon to version 10 format before you move to version 10, and then in version 8 or version 9 continue to use that recon until the migration actually happens. The way that you do that is with the change.recon upgrade utility. It uses the IMS version 10 DBRC utility, which is DSPURX00. Now that utility is an online utility. It may be executed while the subsystems are running. The amount of time it takes is actually fairly short. If you do a repro of one of your recons, that will give you an indication of how long it takes to run this change.recon upgrade. Now, when you've got the maintenance installed, you'll be able to do the upgrade, and then that takes one piece off the critical path as you do the migration to version 10. There is a coexistence level information added to the subsystem record listing, which is added by V10 and V10 coexistence SPE for version 9. And then it's the standard style of upgrade. The upgrade from version 8 or 9 to 10 reads the subsystem records to check that it's got the SPE. It updates the recon header record. It updates the recon header extension record and all of the other records, and it's very fast. Min version, if you have a minimum version prior to version 8 or 9, it will set it up, prior to version 8, it will set it to actually version 8. And then the flex band and group ID will be upgraded there as well. So the DBRC migration what you need to do is to install version 8 or version 9 DBRC migration and coexistence SPEs, install the IMS version 10 DBRC Type 4 SVC, upgrade your recons using the IMS V10 ResLib, and then begin using IMS 10. Once you've discontinued all use of IMS 8 and 9, then you can change your recon to set the minimum version to 10, and the full version will be used in timestamps. Full precision then will be used in timestamps. So that covers off fairly quickly, I must say, but covers off the information on upgrades to DBRC with IMS version 10. Are there any questions? Okay, well, let me then pass the baton across to Robert. So, Robert, your call now for the last piece of this class, which is migration and coexistence.
Well, again, everyone, I'm just bringing the screen up. Can everyone now see the installation migration heading? While I'm waiting for that to come up, I've got one question for everybody. I'm assuming everybody here is running either IMS version 8 or IMS version 9. Is there anybody running an earlier release of IMS? Please speak up. Well, I hope that's a good sign. Okay. Not that you're
going to come. I imagine it is.
Yes. Not that anyone would have got into trouble, but it just means that some of the migration stuff, if you're going to migrate off an earlier version than 8 or 9, gets a little bit more complicated. Let's move forward. Installation migration. There are several components to this part of the presentation. First of all, there's the packaging, prerequisite and coexistence requirements for the migration. We discuss the IMS library changes to the manuals. We talk about some of the IVP enhancements, the syntax checker utility enhancements. We talk about the KBLA and the coexistence between releases for KBLA, the tasks for installation, the migration, and then a review of all of that. This is something that every one of you will at some point in time need to go through, so definitely please speak up if you do have any questions. So first of all, we'll look at the packaging, prerequisites, and coexistence. Okay, minimum software levels are, you need to be running ZOS version 1.7 or higher. RACF or equivalent, if you want any security. And you need to have the high-level assembler toolkit installed to be able to implement IMS version 10. If you're using IRLM, you need to be using IRLM version 2.2. And 2.2 is the only IRLM shipped and supported along with IMS version 10. If you are running... That's on the next screen. That's on this screen. If you're running database recovery, fast replication, well, then you need to be running ZOS version 1.8 as it requires the functionality of that operating system. If you require the functionality of the parallel recon access that Jeff was just talking about, then, you, as he mentioned, you need to have the ZOS transactional VSAM, DFSMS TVS, which is a separate orderable feature. So it's a separate product outside of IMS that is a prerequisite if you want that functionality. And if you want to use the Enterprise Workload Manager, you need to have either ZOS version 1.8 or you can have 1.7 if that PTF itself is actually installed. For any more details on specific requirements for any other functions, refer to the IMS version 10 release planning guide. The release planning guide is freely downloadable from the IMS homepage. Connections, supported connections. ISC, MSC, and shared queues are all supported between all the versions. IMS is version 8, 9, and 10. Obviously, if you have something prior to that,
that would get a little bit more complicated. But between supported versions of 8, 9, and 10, IC, MSC, and GQs are all supported. To that end, as a bit of a tangent, as we've mentioned before, IMS typically has a double version jump allowable as a supported release. So whenever we bring out a new version, you can jump to it or migrate to it from the previous version or the one before that. So there's version 8 and 9 are the two versions you can get to 10 from as it's supported. IC and DB control is supported with the Qix transaction server versions 3.2, 3.1, 2.3 and 2.2. If you've got DB2 connections, that we will support connections with DB2 versions 7, 8 and 9. An RLM 2.2 can talk to RLM 2.1 with a few caveats. RLM 2.1 is supported in IMS version 8 and version 9, but RLM 2.1 is not supported with IMS version 10. RLM 2.2, which comes with IMS version 10, will connect and talk to RLM 2.1 if you still have that running against your version 8 or version 9 system. So the synopsis of that basically is when you upgrade your IMS, you need to upgrade RLM on that it's connected to as well, on the LPAR that it's running. DBRC. This is a bit similar to one of the screens that Jeff had in his presentation just then. If you want to go from IMS version 9 to IMS version 10, you need to upgrade your recons. But before you can do that, you need to add the version 9 SPE so that the IMS version 9 system can read the IMS version 10 recons. And similarly, IMS version 8 to version 10, you need to have the version 8 SPE for IMS version 10 installed in IMS version 8 so that IMS 8 can read the IMS 10 recons. Why would you want to do this, or why do you need to do this? Well, apart from the fact if you're running an IMS sysplex and you need to upgrade one IMS at a time, the IMSs you haven't upgraded can still access the recon using the newer format. If you have upgraded to IMS and for whatever reason you needed to back out, you cannot back out the recon. Because once you've updated the recon with data, with log information and image copy information, you can't back it out. You can't go back in time. So if you do need to back out, your older system, version 8 or 9, still needs the requires the ability to access your IMS version 10 formatted recon. With IMS version 8 to 10, they will also provide compatibility for IMS 10 using the HelderB online reorg. And there are other coexistence maintenance, for the global online change, for systems management, for operations management, etc. All of that is in the notes if you do want to look in more detail, depending on what the functions are that you've got. But if you do have any specific functions like that, you will need to check the notes or indeed check the release planning guide. But the most important ones, certainly that everybody will be impacted by, are the DBRC SPEs. Any questions on that? Because that's critical to all sites. I assume not. Okay, the coexistence of the IMS utilities. For batch backout, log archive, and log recovery, you need to use the utility from the IMS release that created the log. The IMS version 10 database recovery utility, it will accept image copies produced from IMS's versions 10, 9, and 8. It will accept HiSAM unloads produced from IMS 10, 9, and 8. It will accept change accumulation data sets from IMS 10, 9, and 8, and logs produced by IMS 10, 9, and 8. And the IMS 10 change accumulation utility will also accept logs and change accum data from any of the three versions. The important part on that screen is the first line. You've got to use the utility that the IMS release was created with if you're going to do any batch backout, log archive, or log recovery. So it's much better to make sure you've got a clean clean slate as you're migrating through, if at all possible. A clean slate from a recovery perspective. Or your utilities will just need to refer to the older version if you need to use the logs from the older version of IMS. IMS tools migration and coexistence. There's a screen you can get to from the IMS webpage, and it's listed on the screen there. And it will help explain what the support and migration and coexistence information is. If you've got non-IBM products or other vendor products, you need to certainly speak to the vendors and ensure that their versions are compatible with IMS version 10 before you migrate. But the website for the IBM IMS tools, you can see there, you go to the website listed, click on support, click on the IMS tools and IMS compatibility, and IMS version 10, and you'll get to a screen as is shown on the picture, and you can go through there, and it will tell you what maintenance, if any, or what version, if any, is required is compatible to IMS version 10. The Q Control Facility product has a specific comment here. There are some APARs you need to implement to allow fallback from IMS version 10 to either IMS version 8 or 9, so that the older versions of IMS can recognize the version 10 messages, and there's a few APARs mentioned there. IMS library reorganization. The IMS manuals have been restructured. The release planning guide has a good list of which manuals are mapped to which ones, but needless to say, they're all available and free download from, as long as you've got an IMS license, from the information centre. That there's an example of it here. There's a link to it from the IMS homepage. The URL actually isn't listed on the screen here. But if you go to the IMS homepage, www.ibm.com/IMS, and you just go to the library link, that'll take you to the information centre, and you can find the manuals for all versions of IMS. And you can then download the appropriate manuals, or all the manuals, if that's what you want to do. Or you can just access them and search for them and use them from the information centre. So online, certainly searching for certain items, you don't need to know exactly which manual they're in, but if you do have hard copy manuals or you print them off, the format has changed, the way they're structured has changed dramatically. So it'll take a little bit of getting used to for all of us, but just be aware. Now we talk about some of the IVP enhancements. Okay, there are some IVP enhancements for some of the existing functions. There's support of RACF implementation and SMU removals that's included in the IVP. There's now an IMS Java sample application and an IMS Connect sample application. So it gives you a better idea on how to utilize both Java and IMS Connect applications just by simply going through the IVP. The IVP supports new functions from the operations manager for the subscribe or unsubscribe sample, as we discussed yesterday with the unsolicited messages that you can subscribe or unsubscribe to from the operations manager. There's a sample for that. And there's a dynamic resource definition user interface, a DRD UI, that's now included as part of the IVP. It continues to be invoked as in previous releases, and there's an example there of how you, from ISPF option 6, can execute DFS IX C01. Or you can access it from the IMS application menu. One of the options on the IMS application menu does go to the IVP. Operations Manager sample. There's also IMS version 10 provides a TSO SPOC sample to view all the messages and display information from the audit trail, which will help give you an idea of what that's all about. There are some modified IVP steps that will add the new parameter audit log equals to the audit trail log dataset name in the OM proclib, and it will add the coupling facility resource manager and logR policy definitions to the new audit trail log dataset. So it will set up to allow for all the audit trail information automatically if you choose those options within the IVP. Next we go straight to the syntax checker. And again, all of these topics, there's more information available in the handouts that you've been able to download or in the manuals, but given the time requirements, this is just a summary and a pointer at all the different items. Syntax checker enhancements. IMS now supports, IMS version 10 now supports the syntax checker for a number of different members in the IMS proclib, both existing ones and new ones. There's some new display formats, there's some new keywords, so you can expand, contract and insert values. There's new selections in the view menu and new member selection panel. So let's have a look at each of those. IMS version 10 syntax checker. It now supports the three IMS proclib members as it has done in previous releases, being the DFS PB, DFS DC, and DFS SQ members. And again, it depends on whether you're coming from version 8 or version 9 as to which of those is valid. Certainly version 9 had all three. In IMS version 10, it now supports the following members. The DFS DF member, the new member that we talked about, DFS CG, DFS OI, DFS CSL OI, CSL RI, CSL SI, CQS IP, CQS SL, and CQS SG. It also supports the IMS configuration member, IMS Connect, configuration member, and the BPE user exit list member. So there are many more parameter members within your IMS proclib that can be managed using the IMS version 10 syntax checker. This will help you not only ensure that you've got the syntax correct and the values you've specified correct, it also will ensure it can help you migrate any changes that are needed between the various versions. That's all coded in. It also has help features so that for each value you can push the help key, and it will tell you a little information about each value, what it is for, and what the accepted values are, making the coding of those members much easier and much faster. And please note that the syntax checker support for IMS version 7 has disappeared. Any questions on the syntax checker? We'll move on. On to KBLA coexistence. The knowledge-based log analysis utilities are part of the IMS ISPF panel. That's one of the options there. KBLA now supports the IMS version 10 log record changes. It has support for concurrent KBLA supported levels, i.e. for IMS version 9 and 10. It ensures the correct log record D6 are used for the corresponding IMS version of the log records, and it generates JCL appropriate to the IMS release. So for ease of migration to IMS version 10, ensure that all the prior release parameters are not invalidated or superseded by the installation of IMS 10. There's a new panel to facilitate migration, and you don't have any reconfiguration required for setup. That was it for KBLA. Installation and migration. This is just an overview of the tasks required for migration to IMS version 10. Remember that IMS version 10 is the first release of IMS not to support BTAM or the security maintenance utility. Their use, in the notes it says, should be discontinued, but they must be discontinued before migrating to IMS version 10, because they will not work. You should check the PSP bucket available from IBM Link or from your IMS service path, and that will help explain what should be reviewed before you begin the migration. You should then also review the program directory, which comes with the product or can be downloaded, and it has some specific product-specific installation information. Then you should review the installation information in Chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the Installation Verification Guide, remembering that the names of these manuals have changed, and the ZOS interface information in Appendix G of the Installation Verification Guide that obviously has information about the SVCs and other information like that. And then ensure you've installed all the prerequisite software, the third-party software, the IBM utilities. Ensure all compatibility maintenance has been implemented on your current version of IMS. I'm getting ahead of myself. That's what's on this screen. Apply the coexistence maintenance to other IMS systems. Ensure that the DBRC coexistence SPEs are on. The system management enhancement coexistence SPEs are on. Global online change coexistence SPEs. Or the operations management coexistence SPEs, all of these as appropriate depending on which functions you're using. Evaluate and update any IMS exit routines, such as the Recon IO exit routine. Install IMS version 10 using SMP, and it comes for either via the CBPDO or the server pack if you're ordering it directly from IBM. And then run the IVP. And the IVP installation panels, you can migrate your variables from previous releases and it will install it in a similar manner to your previous release. You need to do an all-gen of IMS. That hasn't changed. Still need to do that. Obviously, once you've done that, you need to implement and install the Type 2 and Type 4 SVCs into the operating system. Review the IMS resource cleanup module considerations. In IMS version 10, it uses a dynamic resource cleanup module, but do not delete the IMS version 8 module for resource cleanup until all IMS version 8 use has been discontinued, because you may still need it. Once you've done all of that, you can then upgrade the recons, and you need to run an ACB gen. An ACB gen, PSB equals all. And this is where the ACB gen has a unique format and it needs to be unique to that IMS. So if you're in an IMS Sysplex environment, each IMS will have its own copy of the active A or B libraries. So you'll need to do that for each IMS as you roll around an IMS Sysplex. A review of all of that. Well, we've got the transaction scheduling. This is a bit of a review of the entire course, really. We're getting near the end, and we're a few minutes early, which is terrific. Transaction scheduling, the SCHD parameter on the system definition for the transact macro is now ignored, and effectively SCHD equals 3 is always used. For FastPath, if you have FastPath, the FastPath macro FPCTRL is eliminated. It is no longer needed and is ignored. It will not stop your IMS gen from running, but you'll get a warning message. You then, instead, if you are using FastPath, you must then implement the FastPath equals yes or no parameter to enable FastPath, because the default is no. And you need to make sure that the DBBF, DBFX, vSize, or output thread parameters are all specified at IMS startup time in the DFS PB member, as opposed to using the values from the IMS gen, because the IMS gen values won't exist anymore. So make sure that you code that appropriately for the values that you're currently actually using. And this will actually simplify the implementation of FastPath. So So from a migration perspective, FastPath users must specify SPY and values for the other parameters at execution time. Keep in mind from an automation perspective, the DF... that's a typo on the top of the screen, I just noticed, yes. DSP1929, it should be DFS1929i system startup message, is now displayed twice. Firstly, and compatible with the old versions, the values as read from either the IMS Stage 1 or from the DFS TB startup member. And then it's displayed again based on the values that it's read and possibly changed after it's read the IMS log. So any values that were maintained across a warm or emergency restart will be displayed in the second instance of the message. So if you have any automation picking up on that message, you need to ensure that it can cater for the fact that all these messages come up twice. And in the new, there's some new header information that will now provide the IMS version number and the control region type. So it's very easy to tell that you're what level of maintenance or what version of IMS you're running. Any parameters which do not apply to the system are eliminated. And as I mentioned, it's sent twice. MSC migration considerations. If you are using any of the old MSC exits, you must migrate off them. The four exits listed there no longer exist or no longer function within IMS version 10. They are no longer called. And you must migrate the functionality you've got in those exits into the new exit DFS MSC E0. Well, it's not a new exit. It's been around since IMS version 7. So you've had three releases of IMS in which to do this migration. From a bandwidth perspective, migrate using the default of non-bandwidth mode in IMS version 10, which is compatible with previous releases. And then, after you've done the migration, you can enable the bandwidth mode using the update command. And it requires both partners of the MSC link to be at IMS version 10. And you can adjust the buffer sizes. And to do any have any effect, the buffer should be large enough to accommodate multiple messages. So if you're able to analyse how large your MSC messages are, you can size the buffers accordingly. And your performance ought to improve. For the log transaction analysis, log merge and statistical analysis utilities, keep in mind that the old log transaction analysis utility JCL will continue to work, but the specification of no log or no report on the job on the step card will be ignored, as these actions are now controlled by the presence or absence of DD statements. The log merge utility will continue to work as it is, but not it's no longer required, as multiple logs can be specified as input to the other utilities. The old statistical analysis utility JCL must be modified. The old one will not work. Previously, it was running as six steps. It now runs as a single one step. So you certainly, for that utility, need to check the manual for the valid JCL to run it with now and change your JCL accordingly. And obviously, logs from any previous release are not valid input to these version 10 analysis utilities. So if you need to go back and analyze the statistics or data out of any of the previous versioned IMS logs, after you've migrated, you will need to keep a copy of the previous release SDFS RESL data set around and the old JCL, as you will need to use the old IMS load library and the IMS JCL to run these utilities against the IMS version 8 or IMS version 9 logs. DBRC timestamp precision. Migration considerations. Full position is used only after you've set the minvers parameter to 10.1. Fallback to minvers less than 10.1 requires the deletion of recon log records. So once you have upgraded to IMS 10, you really shouldn't change that value until you are 100% certain that you will not be backing out to the previous version. utility control statements are changed and are unlikely to affect users. No, sorry, the utility control statement changes are unlikely to affect users. The genjcl.ca and the genjcl.recov create correct statements. The recon listing and message outputs include full precision timestamps once you've done the minvers set to 10.1. So implications of that, other than the better precision, is if you've got any automated processes that list any recon information and then analyze it using Rex or some other tool, you need to ensure that they can cater for the fact that you'll have larger timestamp fields throughout the output. If you're issuing a command that has timestamps in it, the abbreviated timestamps are usually supported. There are no changes to the BBRC API, as the timestamp continues to be 12 bytes internally. And the timestamp precision of the genjcl.user output could change, depending on the minvers level. Unless, of course, you do something in your skeleton JCL. And that is that. That is a summary, almost a six-hour summary, of everything available in IMS version 10. Obviously, there is a lot more detail available for every single one of the items that we've discussed, and that can be made available either through the IMS manuals, through the IMS release planning guide, through the presentation material that you've been able to download, or you could contact Jeff or I, if you've got any other requests for detail on any particular function if you can't find it anywhere else. And I think we're done. So does anybody have any general questions either on that last installation and migration topic or on anything to do with today or yesterday's discussions?
Yeah. It must be... okay. Question okay?
Yes, go for it.
It must be yesterday's SMU and want to question on 2 points. The system over which I am taking church schedules the shift from SMU to RAC next year. Then it was introduced yesterday, the conversion utility from SMU to RAC, for instance, this DSSK-CIMS, seems not to be being offered in an initial version of IMS version 9. Has the standard been being offered to this since last year?
The utilities to assist with the SMU conversion to RACF, they are available for IMS version 9 and version 10. They come with... They aren't part of the base of IMS version 9. Obviously, they didn't exist when IMS version 9 first came out. And all of the functionality has been added along with a number of different APARs.
Oh, okay.
So for that function to exist within SDFS RESL, then you need to be at a certain level of maintenance. That's William, is it?
Okay, and the other question, okay?
Is that William?
What?
So anyway, the maintenance, I can bring that up screen up again if you like and give you the PTFs that are applied, or you could email me and I can give you the list of the PTFs necessary for...
After that, is this utility good in understanding of obtaining PTF with other?
Sorry, could you say that again, please?
Is this utility, for instance, this DFSKGIMS, this utility is good in understanding of obtaining PTF with other?
I still didn't quite catch that. I can give you I can give you a list of the PTFs you need to be able to implement that functionality into IMS 9.
Oh, okay, okay. I got it. Thank you for answering.
Okay. If you have any questions, send either Jeff or I an email.
Okay.
My email address, rhain@au1.ibm.com.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay. Any other questions from anybody?
Well, if there are no more questions, I would like to thank you very much for coming along. It's been wonderful to teach with you. It's quite a different experience to teach like this, but I hope that it's been valuable for you. Certainly for Robert and I, it's been valuable. So if there are no more questions or no more comments...
Does Nikki want to come in and say anything at the end to close off the call?
No, maybe not.
If there's nothing further, that does conclude today's conference, and we do thank everyone for their participation today.
Thanks very much for your help tonight, Nikki. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. And you both have a wonderful
day. Thank you all, everybody. If you've got any questions, email Jeff or myself. But the information is all there.
Thank you very much.